This week's episode of the Android Central podcast is brought to you by MintSim, the best way to get cheap 4G LTE data in the US. Use offer code ACFREESHIP for free first class shipping on any MintSim purchase right now. Hey, everybody, and welcome to the Android Central podcast. My name is Daniel Bader, and after a brief trip to the other side of the world, I am back in the hosting desk. But last week's host is here to provide all of the color, all of the shiny Sony Xperia hot takes. I'm not going to do that again. Andrew Martinik, how are you, sir?
I am doing just fine, and I have to ask right off the top, did you listen to last week's episode? And if so, or if not, how do you rank our performance?
Well, I have to admit I haven't heard it. I'm sure it was wonderful. I rank it the best episode I've ever not heard.
Yeah, that's how you know you didn't listen right there.
I mean to listen to it, but I only got back a couple days ago. And there's a couple of things I still need to do, including introduce Jerry Hildenbrand. How are you, dude?
I'm pretty good. How are you?
I'm okay. I'm still jet-lagged. Yeah. I was in Turkey. My wife's family is from Turkey, got shepherded all around the country. It was a very cool trip.
Yeah,
very interesting country.
Looked like a blast.
Lots of good food, amazing beaches, very nice people. Driving in Turkey, however, harrowing. I will say that it'll put hair on your back. So one thing.
Did you get to see the Straits?
No.
That's on my bucket list, and then I just was.
It was going. I mean, it's one of those things where you know it's a huge country, and I didn't get to spend a lot of time in it. So we had to choose between three cities. We went to Istanbul, Bursa, and Akçay, which is by the sea. And if you've ever been to Turkey, you'll know that those are three very, very different places with some very, very different environments. So anyway, that's not tech-related, but I did spend a lot of time using a Moto Z2 Play there, and it performed admirably. So we'll start there because we have some follow-up from last week. I know you guys did talk about the Moto Z2 Play a little bit, but Well, I'm the only one of the team who has used it, so I guess I should talk about it.
Yeah, that'd be helpful.
I mean, before I do that, though, like you guys did have a little bit of time to breathe it in. You know, is this has it made an impression at all on you, Andrew? Like, did this give you any reason to go, oh, Motorola is actually figuring stuff out?
Well, It's really, I've kind of just been living vicariously through the other members of the team because everybody else seems to have spent more time with the latest Moto phones than I have. So the one thing that I've taken away, though, is that people really like the Moto Z Play. It was this nice middle ground where, it kind of almost felt like the OnePlus phones in that, like, they give you more than the money, but they're not like super flagship level. And so I can't blame Moto for wanting to just give that one a bump first. Although it just seemed a little odd to me to not see as big of a bump in the processor and actually see the battery decrease in the name of thinness. Mm-hmm. But this really feels like this is the core like Moto experience, because it doesn't have the shortcomings of the Moto G series and it's not super expensive where it's tougher to compete like a Moto Z Force or Force Droid Force, whatever they want to call it. So I really like the idea of the Z2 Play. It seems like this is the nice meat and potatoes middle for Motorola. But at the same time, it's like the same kind of stuff where announce it, doesn't come out for another month and a half or whatever, and then it's also only going to be on Verizon at that point, and it's just like the same kind of stuff like that, and not enough people are going to experience it. And that's kind of, I mean, we've made it the last 9 months or so, and like I said, I haven't even really spent much time with the Moto Z series because it just doesn't feel as important. And I don't think that the Z2 Play in itself is going to propel it up, you know, the Moto Z or Moto line up higher in people's consciousness.
Right. Yeah, Jerry, I mean, I know you had thoughts. Like we so, you know, me, Phil, Andrew, you were at the launch last summer,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, you were there with Alex and I and Phil. We had a pretty decent experience. You know, it was part of Lenovo's Tech World event. Ashton Kutcher made a fool of himself on stage, as he does.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was a lot of excitement other than the fact that the Moto Z itself didn't have a headphone jack. but the Play only got launched a few months later, and it's interesting how the Play is now the first phone of the new generation to be announced. Jerry, do you think there's a reason for that? Is there, you know, is it just that the Play sold 10 times as many as the Z itself?
Yes, and we're seeing Lenovo's business model, and this part fascinates me. Lenovo is taking the Moto brand, and they're really gonna give it the treatment, the same thing they did with the ThinkPad brand, in my opinion, and that can get a little bit, you know, confusing with so many different models, and some of them are very close together. But I think the Z2 Play is the one that they're saying consumers, this one is probably the one you'll want to buy. There'll be some lower end ones for people who need or want something lower end. And I'm convinced they're going to reintroduce the X, like the leaks and rumors have said. And there'll be a super high end one. But to Lenovo, this is the one you are supposed to buy. It came out first. It's going to get the most attention. And it's going to be the one we talk about more.
Yeah. So, I mean, let me give you my impressions of it, because I agree with you. I think the phone, I mean, if you haven't read my review, you can do that right now. But the phone is fantastic. It is considerably thinner than the Z Play, and that actually has a tangible makes a tangible difference in how you use it, because you're not kind of like paw gripping the phone the way that you do a much thicker device. The back is now aluminum rather than glass, so it's not getting super scratched. You don't have to baby it.
That seemed like a smart move.
Yeah. And that's also consolidating the Z and the Z Play into the Z2 Play. So you have a lot of the heart, you know, a lot of the core features of the original Z plus the headphone jack moving into the Z2 Play. So even if you don't get a Z2, which, you know, we may not, but even if we don't, this is a good flagship. The fact that it's $50 more expensive likely means that there won't be a Z2 Play or a Z2. I don't know that for a fact. I have no reason. You know, I spoke to Motorola and they kept a lot of stuff close to the chest, but I don't know whether there's going to be a Z2. I think that there is a good reason to skip it. It didn't sell well. The Z Play sold better. The Z4 sold better because it was the flagship. And I have no doubt we'll see another Z Force variant later this year. So the phone's really good. Screen's okay. You know, the processor is what it is. It's not an upgrade. It's only a 10% clock bump. There's no CPU improvements at all. And, you know, I think I made a big deal about that in my review, and some of the other reviewers kind of got on my back about it. And it wasn't so much that I thought the 625 is an old or poorly performing chip, but that this, now that we know what's in the 630, which got announced a couple weeks ago, you know, it's not necessarily the performance improvements, even though there's a much better GPU in there. It's the cellular stuff. It's the camera stuff. It's that I'm hurting after using the Z2 Play, because, for example, it only supports 2x carrier aggregation. It only supports up to 300 megabits per second.
This is again, such a Daniel complaint, by the way.
I know it is, but it's also indicative of the fact that, like, if you have a Snapdragon 835,
I think the stuff makes a bigger difference.
Hang on a second, I agree, but if you have a Snapdragon 835 or even an 821, you know, you're a year or two ahead of where you are on cellular performance than the 626, and again, it's not a huge problem in day-to-day usage, but it does keep you behind when it comes to network upgrades. And that makes a tangible difference in the way that you use your phone, because as networks themselves, as AT&T and Verizon and Sprint and T-Mobile upgrade their towers and introduce new technologies like 4x4 MIMO and gigabit LTE and all that stuff, you aren't taking advantage of those improvements. But not only that, your phone is actually holding back the newer phones on that network. And you're contributing to slowdown because you're not allowing the network to be more efficient. So the fact that a manufacturer like Motorola is introducing a brand new phone, again, this phone isn't even available yet, with a baseband chip that's 2 years old already, means that you're not, if you hold onto this phone for 2 years, by 2019, you're really disadvantaging yourself, but also other people on the network. Yeah. Again, inside baseball, but it is what it is. The camera stuff, that's where this phone kind of falls flat. It's got the same specs as the Galaxy S8 and as the Moto G5 Plus, which, on paper, they're identical. It's 12 megapixel sensor, f1.7 lens. Theoretically, it's very good, but this camera is just okay. It's not great in low light. It's splotchy. It's not very fast. And that's, again, where the Snapdragon 630 would have improved. So that's my 4-minute rant. It's a great phone. It has some odd choices. The 3000 milliamp hour battery certainly does not lift it to where the Z Play was. I get a day of use, but I occasionally hit red after, at like 7-8 o'clock. But it's software is really what saves the whole experience. Motorola did some really nice subtle improvements to things like Moto Display, and yeah, I give it a solid B+. So if it's $499 when it launches, that's probably going to be too expensive, but Verizon will sell it for about $450, I think.
Yeah, that's the big thing for me. It feels like I know Jerry almost got there when he was talking about it. It feels like this is like a tailor-made for the carrier type of price point, where there's plenty of money to be made in Verizon discounting this a little bit, mostly advertising it as $15 a month or $19 a month or whatever when it first comes out. It's not really going to be sold, at least in North America as, unlocked, especially right off the start, because Verizon has that exclusive. But if you do look at it at that full price, it's kind of weird, because like an LG G6 is $499 or $549 or something like that, and has a larger battery. And I mean, people dogged on the G6 for having a Snapdragon 821 rather than 835, but an 821 is a huge step up from a 600 series chip. I mean, Daniel's talking about maybe they could have held out for a Snapdragon 630. It's like, well, the G6 has an 821 in it, much more efficient, much more powerful, and you get those camera benefits. That's where, I mean, you really have to like that design, the mods, and the software, which I think there is value there. But this really does feel like something that is tailor-made for Verizon to sell on a monthly finance and not necessarily go toe-to-toe in the open market.
It's the Motorola name. Let's not forget that. You listen to podcasts about phones, you know what Motorola is right now, but for people who don't keep up on this, the name Motorola means something. And Verizon, like Andrew said, can, give us $59 and $18 a month, and you can have this sweet new phone from Motorola that works on our fast 4G LTE network. And that's going to sell a lot of phones.
It's interesting you say that, because you're right, especially if you compare it to the rumored, say, $499 price point of the OnePlus 5. So, this is going to be a $499 phone, unlocked, and the OnePlus 5, if it is $499, these are choices that the unlocked buyers are going to have to make, and they're going to just completely overlook the Moto Z2 Play. But we know Motorola's strategy here. They do it every year. They introduce a phone at a much higher cost than what they end up selling it at 2 months later. So the Moto Z, for instance, got introduced at, what, $699 or $649?
Yeah. So, yeah,
which
outrageous.
Was insane, right? It was far too expensive. But you could find it for $350, $400 at Motorola.com by, you know, the end of the year. And the phone is just a conduit for the Moto mods. So you'll get a free Moto mod with every purchase. I'm sure they'll start that out when they start selling the phone later this summer unlocked. And one thing that I really found interesting about the conversation I had with Motorola's head of marketing from this little event that they held a couple weeks ago is that most people, practically all Moto Z owners, use Moto mods. It's one of those symbiotic relationships, which is good because that's exactly the intention. But very rarely do people buy or use or even associate the Moto Z line with just the phone. So if I'm reviewing the Moto Z2 Play on its own, I'm actually not reviewing the product that Motorola is selling. And I'm not doing them a full, you know, I have to review it on its own because Android Central reviews phones. But from a marketing perspective, that's actually not what they're doing. They're selling the phone as a conduit for Moto mods, which is a, you know, these are hugely profitable. Like they're not making a whole lot of money on a $500 phone, but they're making a ton of money off a $279 Hasselblad Moto mod.
Well, they're making a way more money on even the $15 style shells or whatever that cost $3 to make. I mean, those and the Qi backs and the battery backs, those are where the big money's at.
Totally. So again, like you have to keep this product in perspective. And I mean, Alex, even what he wrote about OnePlus and its expanding world of accessories. Now, this is very much how companies are making money these days. OnePlus is certainly not making a whole lot of money selling the OnePlus 3T for $439. So Motorola is doubling down on this Motomod strategy. What's very interesting, though, is that it's cutting out one of its symbiotic products in the Moto Z and bringing the Moto Z2 Play up by $50 to kind of compensate. And whether that's going to be a good thing in the long run, that remains to be seen. So speaking of phones sold unlocked, Andrew, you put out a review today and it had the word disappointing in the title. So I'm not sure I'm super enthused on this, but I did get to use it when it launched at Mobile World Congress. Tell us a little about the Xperia XZ Premium.
And I even quoted you in the review. I'm not sure if you noticed that.
Oh, I did. I enjoyed that.
When you referred to the back as reflective AF, which you can figure out what that means. Because although I did not have the Chrome model, which as you expect, the Chrome model was just absolutely ridiculous. I have the Deep Sea Black one, which I think is the best. I think it's black, chrome, and pink are your three colors. So I'm not really sure how the chrome and pink colors are going to sell. But in general, I'm not sure how this thing's going to sell. So we were just talking about $500 being expensive. Try $800 for this. And
crazy.
It's such a... I found myself when I was writing this review so many times just saying, I can't explain X except for the fact that it says Sony on the back. And so Sony gonna Sony. I mean, that's what the price is. That's what the camera is. That's what the design is. All the way through, everything just says Sony, Sony, Sony in so many ways. And Jerry and I kind of talked about this last week right after I just got the phone. And we were saying, you know, you don't go to Sony for, you know, value for the money. You go to Sony because you like the unique design. And I really grew to like the unique design of this thing, even though it's tall and wide. And I realize it's almost 200 grams, which is insanely heavy for a 5.5-inch phone, way heavier than anything else out there. And even still, I like it because it's so nicely made and it's not trying to be thin or light or sleek or anything like that. It's all about the look and the symmetry. I mean, this is kind of the lineage of this omnibalance design that they've gone well beyond, where it's symmetrical left, right, top, bottom, you know, except for the necessary bits that are different. And all the hardware is great. And it means that it lets them put in, you know, front-facing stereo speakers, still has a headphone jack, has a really nice 4K display, and it has a huge battery that has some of the best battery life I've had on a phone in the last couple of years. I mean, we were just talking about the Moto Z2 Play dropping its battery a little bit. This phone can easily be a two-day phone if, you know, you're just, you're relaxed on your phone a little bit. It legitimately finished days with more than 50% battery, which is not something you get out of a flagship phone. That's usually something you have to go to a lower-end phone for. The problem is, of course, in the US, it doesn't have a fingerprint sensor. And yes, I know, folks in the comments, you can flash a different firmware on it and enable the fingerprint sensor. Like, I know how that all works. But if you're selling an $800 phone, people can't be expected to do that. They just spent $800, you know, plus tax and shipping, whatever, on a phone. They're not going to do that. The bigger problem for me, which Jerry and I talked about last week, was the camera, which ended up being the case. It's super, super, super aggressive on... What would you say, Jerry? It's like, it's the edge detection is really bad. And because it can't tell where the edges of things are, it really, really, really over sharpens them and gets all mushy, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah, the edge detection is too good. Actually, it can find an edge that is actually there, but it shouldn't find it.
Oh, sure. Okay. That's a better way to describe it.
Yeah. And it puts an outline on every single edge, and that makes some of your photos look really weird.
Right, because then it tries to sharpen all of those edges,
right.
Which means that if you just look at something like, I took a picture of a new backpack that I got that has like a fine nylon weave on it, and it just kind of looks all funky because it tries to sharpen every little tiny line. And this is Sony's MO, kind of. I mean, this is a problem that they've had even in their... you know, NEX series cameras.
Right. I use a Sony camera and it does the same thing if you use their intelligent mode. That's just what they do.
Right. So it's just the way that they process JPEGs. So if you go into manual mode, this camera is far closer to the high-end phones out there today because it doesn't do all that fancy stuff where it overcorrects for all these things. The problem is... people don't do that. They see superior auto. They see it as, you know, iAuto, whatever it's called.
Yeah.
That's what they want to shoot in. And it's still, it's just not good. And even when you go to manual, it takes too much coercing. You have to adjust things and mess around. Whereas I can pick up any of the phones on my desk today and take better photos just by picking them up, launching, take a picture. And so Sony still hasn't figured that out. I feel like they have all the tools. It's just the interface and, you know, what you're expected to do with it in order to get those photos is not up to speed. And so I think the last part of that is this 960 frame per second slow-mo, which is just absolutely insane.
It was amazing, but, though.
Yeah, I put a few clips together of my brother swinging a golf club. You know, his club head speed's probably like 100 miles an hour, but it can slow it down amazingly slow. Another one, you know, a guy jumping in a pool and you could see every little water droplet coming off of him and, you know, everything like that. Those are cool. But the camera, in order to do that, you have to switch into a different mode and you have to keep the camera super steady because it crops way in on the sensor and it takes 0.15 seconds of... 960 frame per second video, and so you can't selectively use the slow-mo and all that kind of stuff. So it's one of these typical Sony things where look at what it can do, amazing video, but it's not as practical to use. So when you put those kind of things together, it's like if they executed on these, you could almost justify $800, but as is, I just don't think you can.
So here's an interesting anecdote that I want to add to sort of flesh out this narrative. Most people, I'm assuming, listening to this podcast live in North America, and we have a very North American carrier-centric view of devices on the market right now. Obviously, Sony being Sony, they're hamstrung by a carrier. We don't know who it is, but
it's probably Verizon.
It rhymes with Spurizon. To put a fingerprint sensor on its devices, and that impacts the way that people view Sony as a handset manufacturer in the US. In Canada, it's a little bit different. Sony has a great relationship with the carriers. The XZS and XZ Premium will be available at carriers in Canada. They've had great success with the X and Z line here. So a little bit different, but still not a huge market mover. But in Turkey, I was hanging around a lot of my wife's cousins while I was there, and a huge number of them. So she has a lot of cousins, like her mom. Anyway, I don't want to get personal, but she has a lot of cousins. And I would say half of them have Sony phones. So this is more than 10 people, and half of the more than 10 people have Sony phones. And I spoke with one of them, and he said that the impression that he and his peers have of Sony is that they have the best cameras, better than Samsung, better than Apple. Sony has the best cameras, not to mention the fact that flat out higher megapixels is better. Like that was just, I could not convince him otherwise. He was like, my phone is 23 megapixels, your phone is 12 megapixels, my phone is better. Like categorically, there was no convincing him. And that's very interesting because Sony has always played the megapixel game. It's done it for years and years. It's done the marketing game. And you mentioned it in your review, Andrew, all of those names, the steady shot and the superior auto.
Motion
and
eye.
Right, motion. Like all of these things, they build up Sony as a camera company. And to you and I, that actually may be a problem because what they're doing is they're couching the issues endemic to the phone's camera experience in marketing, and that's their prerogative. But it works. It absolutely works. And people have fallen for it hook, line, and sinker. And I experienced this firsthand. It was interesting because there were, I was around family. We were taking photos. It was a very typical indoor setting, artificial light. Lots of people were using their phones to take photos of others who were moving around. And everybody who had a Sony phone ended up with slightly blurry. Well, everybody's photos were blurry to some extent. But the Sony photos, to my eye, were pretty bad. I mean, a couple of them were using the Xperia Z5. And Xperia Z5 Premium, which have, not the cameras are not as good as the one on the XZ Premium, but they're pretty much based on the same platform, and they just weren't great at all. But they, for some reason, the people there just loved them, and they thought the photos were amazing. So hey, I mean, who are we to judge?
I see that a lot, and this whole. I thought that we were starting to get away from the higher megapixels is better thing, but you bring up a great point that in other markets where it's been ingrained in the fact that more megapixels is better, as we were getting there, probably 3 years ago, where we were really getting to that point where Sony was doing 27 megapixel sensors and things like that. It was like, I felt like Sony might have crossed into a different, not an era, but a different way of thinking, because they actually dropped the megapixels on the XZ Premium. They actually went back down to 19 with this Motion Eye camera, with its Exmor RS sensor and G lens and Bions for mobile or whatever. But it seems to have all the same issues, even though they dropped the megapixels.
Right. But also, they didn't drop the megapixels to 12 the way that Samsung had. I mean, if you look at the trajectory from the early phones, right? You went 8 megapixels on the Galaxy S2, 8 on the 3, I believe, And then the 4 went up to, was it 12 or 13?
I think it's 13 and then 16.
The 5 was 16 and then back down to the 6 was 16 as well. And then the 7 was 12 and the 8 was 12. So, you know, there was clearly an arc there, and most manufacturers did the same thing. And, you know, we've now settled on a compromise where the size of the sensor, the size of the pixels seems to round out at 12 megapixels, right? You get a 1/1. The thing that Sony can hold up to everybody else, though, is that all of its high-end XMOR sensors are 1/2 and 1/3 inches. So they're much bigger than the average smartphone sensor. So they can kind of justify having more megapixels because they average out to around 1.12 microns.
Yeah, they're on the XZ Premium, it's 1.22 microns, even though it's 19 megapixels, which is, you know, that's a big sensor.
Right, exactly. So we see that trend moving. And to be fair, Sony makes all of the sensors that, are, you know, all of your favorite phones use, from the OnePlus to the Galaxy to any practically any phone, even Apple uses Sony sensors, even though they don't come out and say it. So I don't know. I mean, Sony seems to make the best sensors. They just don't know how to put them into their own damn phones.
Yeah, it feels like their tradition of how they process photos, and like we talked about earlier, you know, it's the same thing on their JPEG compression on their NEX cameras, outweighs, you know, being able to actually make changes. I mean, I see a lot of corollaries there to HTC phones for, you know, a few generations there with the end of the main one line and then the M7, M8, where it was like they were so stuck on the fact that, like, we can do this. We're going to go we're going to give you a 4-megapixel camera and we're just going to process the crap out of the photos and believe us, we can do it. It's like, no, you can't. You have to give up and, you know, do something a little more industry standard. And then we get the U11 where it has a typical camera setup and it takes really, really good photos. And, you know, I would love to see Sony do something like that.
Well, I mean, the irony of moving, if you want to use HTC as an example, moving from the 4-megapixel in the M7 and the M8 all the way to 21 megapixels in the M9, like that pendulum just swung and just flew off the damn instrument and broke a couple windows. And the M9's camera was an unmitigated disaster. It was a piece of junk that even HTC now acknowledges was a horrible misfire. So, you know, we know objectively that Sony makes great sensors, because the 1M9, it was not a Sony sensor. I believe it. What was it, Jerry? Was it Toshiba?
Toshiba, yeah, I think.
Yeah. So anyway, they messed that up so bad. But
now, wait, there are Toshiba sensors in a lot of Samsung Galaxy phones that are awesome. So it's more than just
the sensor.
No, I'm not
saying that they are inherently bad. I'm saying that the phone didn't have OIS. It was 19 or 21 megapixels. It had 1 micron pixels.
Yeah,
it was just a bad sensor for the phone.
Right. It wasn't executed properly at all.
Right. Anyway, so
now he got me pulling up the 1M9 review.
I'm sorry. So,
but I think to wrap up that the back to Sony, we were talking about Sony, right? The wrap up point on the XZ Premium was you'd be willing to give up some of these things, like if you like the style of Sony photos, like you said, or you know, you're bought into the Sony photo brand or something like that, you could put up with that, or you could put up with, in the US, a lack of a fingerprint sensor. If we were talking about something like, I think when we reviewed the, when I reviewed the X Compact, or when you reviewed the XZ, which was kind of this mid-high range phone where, like, you expect compromises, but those things just can't happen on the tippy top of the, you know, consumer smartphone level at $800. I mean, people don't spend that much money on a phone unless they're buying a Galaxy S8 Plus or an iPhone 7 Plus. They just don't spend that kind of money on a phone in any meaningful numbers. And so the interesting thing is that Sony to your point about people in other markets still being tied to Sony, in North America, Sony actually sells a lot of mid-range phones in considerable volume because they're able to sell like an XA or now an XZ or whatever, XA1 Ultra, or you know, all these phones that still offer the Sony style and all this branding, still a pretty good screen and unique design, but they're like $399. Or in the case of the whatever the XA was, it was $249 or something. So it was competing with like a Moto G, but it had the Sony name and the design and presumably great Sony camera. Mm-hmm. So it's just that doesn't scale to the super high end where it like, it's a different market.
I want to talk about that price a minute.
Yeah.
I am convinced, and this is just my speculation, people, whatever type of deals and restrictions keep the fingerprint sensor away also affect the price in North America. I can't find it in pink yet, so I'm holding off, but I can buy a Xperia XZ Premium, the exact same phone. It's mm-hmm. a different SKU, but it's the same, even down to the network bands, including shipping and everything with the pound has dropped a little, for $631 delivered to my door with a full warranty and a fingerprint sensor. So the $800 thing has got to be part of the restrictions that are in place from a specific carrier. It's just got to be.
Well, I think it's got to be the fact that they expect to sell about 17 of them in the US. And so, you know, they price it accordingly. I mean, this has always been the case the last couple of years since Sony went all in on selling direct and unlocked in the US.
Yeah.
You could always buy from a much, much, much more competitive and robust market buying from the UK or Europe and importing, because there's a price war out there. There's tons of phones out there wholesale. You know, the price comes down and you can import it. That's always kind of been the thing. The problem is, like, I have to judge it on its MSRP in the US.
Oh, I know. But if you're out there listening and you haven't been turned off yet by our complaints, don't go to Sony. Don't order that version in the US. Go to a place like Clove or any of these independent dealers in the UK. And especially now with the pound a little cheap, buy that one. It's the same exact phone. I've verified when you start it up, you can even choose US English and it's the same software, but it has the fingerprint sensor and it saves you $160.
Oh man, I wanted unnecessary use in all my words.
That's the last Sony phone I imported drove me crazy like that.
Bunch of Americans. Anyway, I you know what? I don't even know why they sell it. That's what I'm
yeah, I'm
interested
I agree.
In like why not just exit the US, the high-end US market completely until this, you know, Verizon fingerprint thing blows over, and then like come back with a bang, you know, tickle T-Mobile until they'll put the phone back on the market. Like these are things that
I don't even think Sony wants to work with T-Mobile anymore.
I mean, they're not going to work with Verizon, so who else is going to take them?
But if it's the same exact hardware and the same software with just a different SKU based on which continent you're in, it doesn't cost them anything to sell them in the US. If they only sell 17, that's a win.
I guess. Yeah, you're right.
I agree. I don't get the overall strategy. I don't think they're going to go back to carriers, but it would be fantastic to see them when this fingerprint thing runs out. Presumably it runs out at some point. They, you know, kind of go back to trying a little bit, you know, rather than saying, it's on sale. Go ahead. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So let's move on to that was basically follow up. So let's talk about what's happened this week. The big news this week is the Android O beta 3 for developers. This is the first one was announced. When was it? Back in March. Second one came out at Google I/O at the end of May or middle of May.
Which is the first beta as well.
Which was the first beta that was available through the Android beta program. Now this is the third overall release, the third developer preview, and the second beta. And there are some significant but subtle updates to this version. And Jerry and I and Andrew, we were talking about whether we can address this as changes to Android O or whether it's just changes to what you see on Google's devices, since those are the only ones that currently have access to the Android O beta. But now the UI, the experience, the stability, the APIs, they're solidifying, and we know that because Google says that the APIs are final, which means that developers can submit apps either as alphas, betas, or as production APKs to Google Play and actually get people, you, me, developers, to test them out. So Jerry, let's walk through what's new in Beta 3 or what's new in Developer Preview 3 and how Android O is shaping up.
You hit on the most important thing. This is the only thing this release really does when you get down to it is allow developers to use the APIs, including Google. Beta 2 had the same exact features as Beta 3, but we didn't know because nobody could use them. Even Google wouldn't use them. If you were a developer and wrote your own apps, you could look at them. But this is now the APIs are final, so Google can say, oh yeah, look what we can do. And you get it on your Pixel, you see some new UI tweaks, some of them great, some of them not so great. But they can also incorporate things like notification channels in YouTube and the kind of things that they couldn't expose before, because when the APIs aren't final, even Google isn't going to use them. And that makes a good visual difference. If you look at the actual changes, and that's what I did, spent a good part of the day yesterday, this is mostly just they fixed a lot of typos in the code, some bug fixes and workarounds. That's what the changes behind the scenes are, but unlocking it so we can see what it looks like made a big impact.
So yeah, let's talk a little bit about the experience. So first, would you think the average person who owns a Pixel or Nexus 6P can go to android.com/beta, opt their device in to the O beta and run it as a daily driver?
I wouldn't yet. I wouldn't recommend it yet.
I would agree.
It's still a little flaky. A lot of apps will close and not respond.
What device are you running it on, Jerry?
The Pixel XL.
Okay, same.
And it's, you know, that's the biggest thing is some of the apps. Does this mean the apps aren't ready? Probably. But the software is also not quite ready. That's why it's still a beta. So if you depend on your phone, I wouldn't do it.
I would say that on the Pixel XL, at least, the less of the interface and like core operations of the phone are broken, which is good. But I'm still having lots of, we've only had it 24 hours and I've been sleeping for a portion of those, but the alarm, like the apps will still crash. I've had Google Calendar, like the widget just doesn't update. And when I restart, like some apps won't open and things like that. So that's pretty typical developer preview stuff, but that's not something that you want when, you know, you're walking down the street and you just need to look at your calendar and it just won't load. So that's why I wouldn't recommend that.
This is to be expected because the way software life works, they get everything new to the point where, yeah, we're willing to release it. Now they need to work on making things backwards compatible and a little more stable. So that guy who wrote the app for Gingerbread and never updated it, it still has a chance to run, which is probably more important than the new changes, because of the way updates are handled.
Well, and I think the bigger issue is we also, if you go to android.com/beta and sign up as I did on my Pixel C and Pixel XL, it just applies the OTA right on top of your NuGet without any data wipe or anything. Right. So you're carrying over all that baggage too. And that could be a lot of the inconsistency that we're seeing.
A couple of small tangible differences, along with, you know, one major, I think, this was not a surprise, but the fact is Android O will be Android 8.0. We now know that categorically. This is part of the third developer preview. Instead of saying Android O under version, it says 8.0. But more than that, there are some small tweaks. So Jerry, let's go through some of them. There's some things that are going to be Pixel launcher specific, and then there are a couple things that we think at least will be across the board. Now, the first one is color-coded media notifications. Yeah.
I would say color-influenced.
Color-influenced, yeah.
I would say color-ruined, but that's just me.
So what exactly does that look like?
To be frank, it looks like ass. It can look great. Andrew shared a screenshot. I think it was Calvin Harris or somebody. And his album art was a nice neutral color. And the notification looked good because it pulls its overall look from metadata in the media itself. But then I looked at a couple from Fleetwood Mac, and I even got one that was orange with blue highlights. And some of them just look absolutely horrible. And that is, there's nothing anybody can do but Google to change that. That's how it's going to be. That's not Pixel Launcher. That's Android and the new notification system.
Yeah, so, it basically looks like it pulls... Like, it looks at the album art of the music you're playing and pulls, like, an average of, like, the light color and the dark color, applies the dark color for the background, and then the light color even changes the color of, like, the play, pause, thumbs up, thumbs down buttons. So the biggest problem that I noticed was the Google Play Music ones, as I scroll back through them, look pretty terrible. But the YouTube ones look particularly bad because you don't necessarily have good album art for every single YouTube video. And when that pops up, it's just like, what is going on?
You look at your favorite YouTubers and you look at their thumbnail, that's Mr. Mobile or Modern Dad. Their thumbnail isn't a scene from the video. They take time and they make a thumbnail because that's how they use it to promote their video. You know, it's usually colorful with descriptive text and, you know, a cropped outline photo of the product. That looks really, really bad.
And I would think that it's just like lock screen album art. Theoretically, it looks good. And there are a lot of album arts for music, especially that on your lock screen when it's in full view, like that looks really cool. But then you're like listening to a podcast that has like a 200 by 200 really simple image, and that gets blown up to your lock screen and you're like, ugh, this looks horrible. So I think the biggest issue for me though is that everything else in the UI is still white or this, you know, kind of light, very, very light gray with black and gray on it.
That's on the Pixel Launcher. We have to remember there we want user definable themes in Android, but Android is easily themeable by whoever builds the software, you know, to run on it.
Mm-hmm.
And I can see this as a way Samsung, LG, you know, probably not Motorola, they're going to darken the UI a little bit to better match some of this colorful stuff.
Oh, absolutely. I just think that the visual inconsistency between allowing media apps to change their notifications so dramatically. I mean, I could see if you just let them just change the background, leave the interface buttons change, you know, stable across apps, something like that would be a much better compromise. And I, you know, wouldn't be surprised if they're still working on that.
Oh, I'm sure. This isn't final. This is still a beta.
What's interesting, though, is that there's been a move over the last few years to maybe not codify, but at least influence the OEMs to deviate less from what Google's doing on the Pixel. And, you know, we see that with the Galaxy S7's Nougat update or Galaxy S8's Nougat, you know, software. It does feel, at least from in the notifications and in other, you know, core system UI experiences, a little bit more like a what Google intended. But it's still quite different, and it's dramatically different in some ways. And you think Google's letting not just OEMs deviate from the way that the Pixel does things, but the developers themselves will be able to influence how these yep. media notifications look.
And I'm sorry, you wonder, that's not good.
It's going to be a maelstrom. It's just going to be a cluster of very individually maybe attractive looks and features, but together it will just be chaos.
I think that the problem there is this is something so core to the interface that you don't want your notifications, which is very much like, you know, the plumbing of the interface. Like, this is, you need this to just work and be replicatable and familiar, and all of a sudden it can start changing right next to other apps that may have also changed it in different ways. I mean, I'm completely all for the apps themselves. You know, when I pull up an app, I expect it to look like that app developer wanted to develop it. But when I'm at home on the home screen, I expect things between apps to be kind of visually consistent. And that's what Android is provided with. You know, you pipe in the information, the notification looks, you know, you have this set parameter of this is what the pause button looks like. This is, you know, how you expand it, you know, et cetera. These are, you know, how the swipe actions work. And I mean, I could see this getting way out of control, especially when we start looking at the long press shortcut actions where, you know, I need those to look consistent. You don't want to long press and see dramatically different interface there. I don't see why you would, you know, expect that it would be okay to have dramatically different interfaces in your notification shade.
Exactly. They have introduced things they didn't like the way that some OEMs do and some custom launchers do with notification dots. They know people want them. Well, they call them dots, some sort of badge. So they introduced a universal that's just going to work everywhere. And then the icon it's on, now they're masked, so they can all look the same. You unify some elements, and then you turn around and say, oh, and developers, you can do whatever you want. I challenge somebody to make a YouTube video with a thumbnail that's black with black text. And let's see how the notification looks in the O beta. Because
that very well could happen as well. I mean, if you just, you're playing music that has really, really dark album art, yep. and you're going to have black buttons on top of a black background.
But then again, I mean, we had that problem for a while when we switched over to the lighter scheme on Lollipop, and a lot of legacy notifications, especially persistent notifications, were black, and the mm-hmm. notification shade was now gray or white.
And we hated it.
They looked like crap, but then the developer got shamed. And if you think about it, you know, Spotify, Google itself with Play Music and YouTube, Pocket Casts, NPR, all the media apps that I use every day, I highly doubt that they'll take very long to conform to at least making these new persistent notifications look good on most phones.
Right.
Oh, it's not them I'm worried about. No, I'm worried about the next tier down where they've made an app that some people use. It has good utility, but all of a sudden now it's not useful because by default, it starts pulling in their album art type stuff rather than by default, it looks like a generic Android notification. I want the default to be something, at least just the default, something that fits into the interface.
Absolutely. Right. I'm not worried about app developers. If your favorite app doesn't update and it looks bad in the notification shade, another company or developer will come along, give you the same functionality and he will update. But the content creators, I do not expect, Daniel, you need to go back to 2010 and start to work on some of them thumbnails, baby. You know, that can't happen. We can't expect all the media on the internet to go back and get updated. And if this, with this as the default, that it just uses the media to define what the notification looks like, that's just hot garbage.
I totally agree with you. I'm worried that we're looking at things a little bit, you know, short-sighted. I mean, there could be a toggle to allow a default notification or just not to show the album art at all. Google may encourage developers not to use this by default and have it as an opt-in. Or by the next developer preview, this may actually be reverted. I mean, if this gets enough negative press, Google could just go back and say, Jerry, we heard you on the podcast and you're damn right. This is a bad idea. But I think that there's a good idea in here somewhere. It's just not implemented well at the moment.
Yeah. Right. Well, I'll give you that.
Yes. And I started this well with, this is still a beta. This can change. Maybe this is Google needed to look at it too. You know, they can dog food it in house and look at their favorite apps and stuff, but man, get it out there where everybody can use it, you know, the way we normally use stuff, because a lot of us are people who are going to flash the beta, even if we shouldn't. And that gives them an idea of how it works in the real world. So I just want to be one of those people that gives them bad press to hope to influence their final decision.
Well, I think they're looking to you first, Jerry.
No, they have some choice words, and then they...
Oh, that's just crazy Jerry talking.
Yeah, that guy, yeah, he complains about everything. He hates everything.
Humble. Elsewhere, I mean, we have these new notifications. Andrew, what else are we seeing from the new 8.0? New developer preview.
Well, is again, we're trying to unpack what's Google's apps updating, what's the launcher, what's Android O itself. But they've fixed a couple of the things from developer preview 2, like the status bar icons being in the wrong order. So that all, like in the notification shade pull down, that all looks like it's, I won't say final, but it looks a lot more set. Would you guys agree, like as far as the notification shade icons, all that kind of stuff, like they seem to be pretty set on that part, right?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
I don't even know anymore.
Like they're removing certain features. Like you can't mess with the system UI tuner as much anymore. They removed that. Yeah. They reverted the Wi-Fi and cellular icon,
which that just feels
again.
Like it was just broken.
It was. Yeah. I bet you it was just broken.
Well, easy to mess that up, and that wasn't a priority, so yeah.
They changed the camera interface just a little bit. They added some nicer animations when you switch between the different modes, and you know, a swipe to switch between photos and videos.
Again, that's just a Google app update.
That's just a Google app, though. So right. There are a couple better animations, stuff like that.
Two things that were added that I think are going to be persistent across all devices, or at least I hope they will. Persistent notifications for apps that are running in the background. So,
oh yes, right. We got.
You know,
if
you have something because of the limitations to overlay apps like Facebook Messenger, Google has forced developers to basically use a different API, and now they're forced to bug you about it in the notification shade.
This is if they don't use the proper API for background running, it shows up in the notification shade saying it's running, right?
If they're using so they haven't deprecated the current overlay API. They're obviously because nobody's running O yet, and for years, very few people will be. I guess what they're doing is they're now saying, if you're going to choose to do chat heads the way you're doing them, you're going to have this persistent notification. And
good.
I don't know. I mean, but Facebook, when it's running in the background, it actually has its own notification for Messenger. So you currently have two of the same notifications.
Well, an app that actually runs in the background at normal priority has to have a persistent notification since like KitKat. But this is a different persistent notification for apps that are alive, but maybe not running as a foreground app. I think, wasn't it YouTube or Google Play Music that we were getting that from yesterday, Andrew?
Both of them, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, Spotify does it. Anything that will have that new media notification will also have the, this app is running in the background.
But it's like, it's not a full notification. It's just this little, you know, 1/3 height notification at the pinned at the bottom of the notifications. But the problem is, it's like, I already have the persistent notification that's giving me playback controls for Play Music. And then I also have a persistent thing telling me Google Play Music is running. It's like, I know. I can't get rid of the notification.
I think this is a great thing because it names the app. I can look and see that Jerry's Wonder app is not acting very nice and it's running and there's nothing I can do to get rid of that except uninstall Jerry's Wonder app.
I think surfacing it to the user in some level is important. The problem is that you're going to... People, you know, if it ends up coming out like this, which again, we don't know how they're going to surface it
right.
Or when, there's going to be this weird situation in which you're going to have apps that you do want to use that are just going to consistently nag you that it's running in the background. Now, I want to know where the line can be drawn in terms of how easy it is for a developer to play by the rules and not get that notification popping up, because that's... Like right now, that's shaming Google's own apps.
Yep, they're fair about it.
The line must be drawn here.
I don't know on a
name that movie.
You know, in a code level, how difficult it is to actually update your app to use the newer APIs. But I know the tools to do it are about a billion times better, so it can't be any harder than the last update a developer made.
I remember them talking at Google I/O about. I mean, I don't think they use the phrase put our foot down, but they are putting their foot down and saying, if you want to run in the background, you have to do it our way, bottom line. Good. Like, that's just, like, if you make your app compatible with API level 26 for Android O, it has to play by this rule by which the only way that you can run in the background is...
Yes.
Again, plumbing, you find the right pathways to surface notifications. You get put into the interruption coalescing, basically, where it, you know, groups up bits of data and pulls them down to multiple apps. You have to play by that rule. And I assume that this notification is, like you said, just for, hopefully, apps that haven't yet been updated to API level 26 and are just in the Play Store. So I would hope that this would be just a nag for those older apps rather than something where you could legitimately download an app that is built for O and you're still getting this double notification thing.
Well, and right now, to be clear, it shows that notification for apps that are targeted to API 26.
That's why I don't want. So, I hope that's not the case.
So I don't think that'll stick. But,
right, but I mean, what's interesting is that Samsung, LG, Huawei, they all have their own, you know, notification nags for apps that are potentially using battery resources. So
yeah,
and they're of various, and you know, they're of various annoyance levels. Right, Huawei's is the worst. It never goes away. You actually have to like crack your phone on a sidewalk before that notification goes away.
And then you should just leave it there.
But if you press the power button and then tap power off, it goes away.
And then you never have to look at it again. But I don't know how this is going to interact with that. What if Samsung just decides to ignore it or integrate this into whatever, you know, resource that they're using? And like I have a good example, you know, the NPR of Canada or BBC, it's called CBC, Canadian Broadcast Corporation. They have a music and a radio app. I discovered that the app was abusing wake locks and my phones were dying, and I had no idea why until I looked at the battery usage. And an app that I hadn't even opened since I restarted the phone was using up to 8 hours of background resources a day. And this was just a problem with the wake locks, and they updated it yesterday to fix it. But if I had had this, I would have known a lot sooner, yeah. Right? Because this is not just apps that are open, that you've explicitly opened in the background. It's any apps that are using consistent background resources without your knowledge. So I think that's important. That's a distinction. And it may really help, but it also may get people into the habit of doing that and just closing those apps.
I know. I mean, I'm just afraid of the thing that you see every single day with every smartphone user, you know, iPhone, there people double tap the home button to start swiping away their apps thinking it's doing something. People open up the multitasking view on their Galaxy S7, swipe away all the apps. And I think that this walks that line where you're trying to make sure that people are aware of what's going on, but you don't want them to think that they need to compulsively close apps all the time because, oh my God, my battery.
Well, I mean, the good news is that only about 40 people will be running Android O for the next year or so. So they
very, very true. But I think that your point about the way that different manufacturers are already doing this is an interesting one. How are they going to handle this move?
Yeah, we'll see.
I'm going to guess they're going to have to get rid of theirs unless they want to see it twice. I'll bet this is going to be there, whether an OEM likes it or not.
Well, I mean, we have to realize that Google is building background limits, you know, into Android O. So, you know, the manufacturers won't have a choice. Things like location limits, the number of times that an app can ping your GPS or geofence location, use Wi-Fi to locate you. Things like, as we said, you know, the apps that use Doze to you know, parse out their updates to save battery. Those are even more limited now. So we have all of these other battery forward improvements to O that should technically make those types of resources unnecessary. Doesn't mean they're going to go away, but Samsung hopefully won't have to include it in its next version.
All this stuff is Google's fault. The entire wake lock thing, the wake locks are a beautiful idea, but they're so difficult to work with, and nobody, the best developer out there, has made the mistake of doing it wrong and locking the CPU open like their app was running in the foreground because they're so difficult. Well, now we have a million apps and half of them do a wake lock the wrong way and kill your battery. So now Google has to figure out a way to fix it. So make Andromeda different, guys, you know, but this is all stems from a really, really good idea that was just too difficult for a developer to implement correctly.
So, I mean, quickly, just to finish up this topic, 8.0, is it justified? I mean, do you guys think that this is a big enough update to justify a jump like this?
I would have, yeah. If you had asked me 2 weeks ago, do you think this will be 8? I would have said definitely. It's a core platform change. It's a big platform update.
Yeah, I think the under the hood stuff that they're doing, all this stuff we're talking about, the way that they're doing vitals, notification channels, managing wake locks, like all that kind of stuff is there. I think that would have in itself probably justified the move. But the fact that they've also changed a lot of interface stuff with the notification badges and obviously the, you know, just the way that the settings and quick settings are laid out, I think that it all adds up to being worth it. And remember, we don't even know the whole story. They're obviously, you know, they're going to hold back a lot of polish and things like that when it comes to finally releasing it, presumably with a new phone too. So we don't even get the whole story yet. And I think that it seems like 8.0 is justified.
All right. Well, you know what else is justified, Andrew?
What's that?
Visiting thrifter.com. You see what I did there?
I agree.
It's called a segue. So, you know, this week is also sponsored by Thrifter. You know, we've spoken about these guys every week. They're our partners here at Mobile Nations, and they have, I think, one of the best newsletters. We have the best newsletter at Android Central. If you haven't signed up for it, do it right now. But Thrifter's got, you know, it's a top five newsletter. And if you go to thrifter.com, you can sign up for it right now. You get all the best tech deals, non-tech deals, internet deals, period, in your inbox every morning. And this weekend, they actually have something that you're going to want to check out. It's a rare discount on a bunch of Sony stuff. So you can get a PS4 Pro, PS4 Slim, or a gold or camo PS4 DualShock 4 controller at like ridiculously low prices. And if you're in the US, you're going to want to check out Thrifter right now for that deal, because if you're listening to the podcast the weekend it comes out, this is a limited time offer. But if you're not looking for PS4 stuff, you can get anything you want, from portable hard drives to smart thermostats to discounts on refurbished DSLRs, all at thrifter.com. A great place to keep in your bookmarks if you don't want to sign up for the newsletter, but we highly recommend that you do. That's thrifter.com. Go there now. You won't regret it.
I have a confession.
Yeah, go for it.
I went to go buy a gold controller.
And I
bought the gold. I mean, I have a PS4 here. I don't play it a lot, but I play it enough. I bought the gold controller, and then I looked. The deal is for so many colors. I ended up getting a gold one, a blue one, and a red one, because $39. Them things are regular $65.
Yeah, I've just guaranteed myself that I'm going to buy a PS4 this weekend. So,
oh, thanks. Heck yeah. See, I didn't have the cash to buy the whole PS4, or I would have, because gold.
Gold. Man, where are my Xbox One controller deals? I probably got to scroll back further.
All right, well, let's move on. Let's finish up talking a little bit about the OnePlus 5. There's some new leaks that look a little bit legit. I don't know, maybe. There's also some definitive release dates. So we now know that the OnePlus 5 will be unveiled on June 20th. That is straight from the horse's mouth, also known as twitter.com.
Noon Eastern.
Noon Eastern. Okay, good. So we have even more specific timing. And
yeah, they've got the live stream published already. You can grab that on YouTube and just wait for a week and a half.
That's like the person who lines up for the first iPhone like 3 weeks before, except you don't have to go anywhere. You can just keep the tab open in your browser. So we have a render of the OnePlus, or at least the top half of the OnePlus 5 that, I don't know. I mean, this was an Android Police exclusive, I believe. And
yes,
it looks legit, right? It has two cameras that are horizontal, a little bit similar to the shape of the iPhone 7 Plus. And it looks like it's midnight black, the same color that was limited edition for the 3T. But I mean, there's not a whole lot else you can tell about the phone. You know that there are, you know, there's a pretty sizable bezel above the top of the display if it's legit. But Jerry, I mean, what else do we know about this phone at this point, right? OnePlus is definitely leaking its own information, I think.
Well, yeah, I mean, on Twitter, the back of the phone, that's not a leak. That's official. It's their banner on their Twitter account. The internet tells me that the OnePlus 5 looks just like an iPhone. Oh my God, how did they do that? Which I guess is a good thing. I mean, it's I don't know how
you can really. I mean, I don't really see it. But
well,
I mean,
bezels and curves and antenna lines equals iPhone.
I think that the interesting thing is that photo that came from the OnePlus Twitter account.
Okay, I just have to apologize. I've been on vacation. I haven't seen this thing yet. I'm just seeing this banner for the first time. They just basically showed off the back of the phone. Okay.
Yep.
Continue. Yeah. But it did corroborate the leak that came from Android Police, which shows us the front. So that's a little bit of information. But the interesting thing, I think the reason why people are pulling this iPhone comparison is, like Jerry said, the antenna lines are kind of from that, you know, from OnePlus's Twitter account. They're the same kind of antenna lines as the iPhone has done, where instead of the little, you know, the little lines or the big straight thin lines, they're kind of more embedded in the metal. And so
basically,
of course, they
what HTC did first with the A9.
Oh, right. But the way that they've done it here, where they try to color match it like they're trying to make it more subtle. And of course, because it curves around that double camera, people think, you know, oh, it must, you know, it looks just like the iPhone 7. But I think, like, when you look at the edge and, you know, the way that it curves, I mean, sure, it's a little iPhone-ish. The finish looks very similar, but I mean, come on, guys.
You know what? I'll go with that. Yeah, it looks a lot like the iPhone or the 7 or the 7 Plus, but so what? That's great. If you want things that you have to do, like antenna lines and a camera lens, you have to have those. Why not make them look good? Eventually, they're all going to start to look the same if they look good.
Would you prefer that they do them the old way just so that they're not the same as the iPhone? It's like, no, if this is the new technology, the best way to put antenna lines in it, then go right ahead. I mean, I think especially like if this Android Police render is legit, the Midnight Black one looks like it hides the antenna lines even further.
And the bezels, you know, I hate to break it to a lot of people, but there are still a lot of other people that really love the iPhone / Pixel / oh my God, look at those bezels with no front-facing speakers, that design. I don't want to buy a phone that doesn't have that because I need that when I hold the phone in landscape because I have big, unwieldy thumbs. I'm not going to knock them for that if this other leaked picture is correct. We have to preface it with that. Outside of the design, it's OnePlus. It's going to be, they're going to push the limits of everything they can because that's what they do. And this is a phone people are probably going to love. Anybody that spends the money to buy it is probably going to love it.
I'm looking at the Midnight Black OnePlus 3T right now, and you can barely see the antenna lines on that phone. You know,
iPhone clone, man.
Yeah, so, you know, come at me, bro, type of thing. Like, whatever. Sorry, go ahead, Andrew. You were saying.
Well, I was saying that, I mean, building on Jerry's point, they're going to do everything that they can, but based on some leaks, like we have a leaked price for India that's like the equivalent of about $500. It sounds like they're going to do everything they can up to, you know, about that $500 price point, which I think some people, like I'd say a week, 2 weeks ago, people were swirling that it's going to be, you know, thinking it's going to be $650 or something, like they're going to go all out. But that's just not OnePlus's game. And so if they can keep it around that $500 price point, that's going to always reframe any kind of complaints that people have.
I'm going to say the same thing I said before. You know, don't be surprised if you're paying more than $550, $560 for 8 gigs of RAM, whatever's going to come in the good one.
Right. That's my second thing.
Just don't be surprised. That's what they cost now.
We expect that we don't know how it's going to be laid out around the world, but I mean, we've been expecting since, you know, 2 months ago that there's going to be some sort of model that has 8 gigs of RAM because, of course, you know, how is the RAM and storage going to be tied together? How is the how are the colors going to be distributed, you know, in different markets, et cetera? Like, those are the two things. I mean,
and if you, the Amazon India leak, I think it's taken down now. This was written by Amazon. And if you look at the source code, it flat out says, you know, 2-something gigahertz, Snapdragon 835, 8 gigs of RAM, 22nd of June. You know, for one of the models. Guys, I'm telling you, that's going to be more expensive than you're used to from OnePlus, but it's still worth it and still a lot cheaper than other phones that don't give you 8 gigs of RAM.
Also, Just if this is true, Jerry, why do you need a phone with 8 gigs of RAM?
You don't. You just don't. A few phones benefit from having that fourth gig. Outside of that, 3 gig, the way you want to look at it, if you're budget shopping, you need a gigabyte of RAM for the phone to start up that holds things in memory that have to be turned on to run the phone and things so it'll work on the network. Set aside a gigabyte for that, another half a gigabyte for graphics, and then what's left is what your applications can run in. When you go to 8 gigs, you are going to be sitting there with 6.5 gigs free more often than not. And it's just complete overkill. But again, this is OnePlus. They can overkill and people love them for it. And who knows? Maybe next year.
But I mean, is it overkill to the point where it's actually a detriment? Because doesn't more RAM actually use more battery?
Slightly. It doesn't take a lot of battery to turn on a bit in RAM. And if the RAM isn't being used, it infinitesimal. You probably won't be able to measure it, but it does exist. Now, if they change it so they use all 8 gigabytes of RAM, it will use a lot more battery, but still, I don't think substantial enough to notice a difference.
All right, so maybe an 8 gig model still sounds a bit nuts, but at least they'll have that, you know, checkbox to hold over other companies.
What this does do for them is for, what is it, Oxygen OS? That gives them, we saw Samsung do it.
More room to breathe.
Yes, they can lock the interface. they can, that was great, by the way. They can lock the interface into RAM to make it extremely snappy. Remember, was it the M7 was the first phone that did that, and people screamed about the multitasking, but to use the phone itself, the home screen and moving through your app drawer was instant. It was beautiful. Nothing else like it.
That's something that Pete Lau, the CEO, brought up in like a big forum post. He said like a focus for this next release is going to be, okay, we're going to get like the most consistent high-end performance out of this thing. And we're going to really, really focus on that. And you got to think that, you know, knowing that you have 6 or 8 gigs of RAM there, knowing you have a Snapdragon 835, as they've already confirmed, means that they can do a lot of things like that and still have plenty of headroom to be able to, you know, let people do whatever they want. I mean, I know we had a bunch of complaints about having 6 gigs of RAM in the OnePlus 3T and oh my God, it's not utilizing all of the RAM and it's kicking apps out and things like that. It's, you know, people are always going to complain about the way that they utilize it, but it does give them plenty of overhead where they can lock the camera and the, you know, the launcher and stuff like that in RAM. And, you know, that can be reserved. You can still play a game and have the game backgrounded and still have an extra 2 gigs or whatever waiting there. And I mean, here's the thing. It's not like it's a huge thing, like expense wise, for them to have a SKU that has 8 gigs. If at the same time, it's also one that has more storage that they have to build extra anyway.
I mean, the rumor is
there's going to be a 64 gig and a 128 gig. So it's like, you know, OnePlus isn't interested in doing a ton of different SKUs. Remember they've done limited edition colors and things like that where they only had 128 gigs of storage in them. You know, you could easily see that happening again where it's just another thing you get. I mean, we're just not to the point where you can say, I want this color with this much RAM, this much storage, and I want a dual SIM model or a single, you know, you're not going to be able to do that. So it might just be something you just get.
Well, I think the most exciting part, I'll be done with this RAM stuff in a minute. If you remember for Oxygen, some of the people they hired were Android community people who took a phone from Samsung and did things to make the UI super responsive and amazing. They're developers, but they're also hackers. These people work for OnePlus and they work on Oxygen. And if they incorporate Vulkan and utilize that extra RAM, they can have a phone that's more responsive than even the iPhone or the Pixel. That wouldn't be difficult to imagine at all. So I'm looking forward to that.
And I'll just add this little bookend to the conversation. If there is an 8 gig version, the bragging rights in China are going to be stupendous. So, you know, you can't discount China as a huge focus for the OnePlus 5. You know, not only did OnePlus skip the 4 in its name because it's considered bad luck in China, but OnePlus is, if we follow the money trail, owned by Oppo or partly owned by Oppo. Oppo, there's a parent company that technically invests in Oppo and Vivo, which are the number one and two handset manufacturers in China right now, respectively. And OnePlus is comparatively tiny, but you can imagine that there are, you know, there's a strategy on how this parent company wants to sell phones in China. How did Vivo and Oppo beat Xiaomi in 2 years? By opening up thousands of retail stores in rural China where people have, you know, weren't able to buy phones online the way that Xiaomi sold their devices. And now, if they're going to properly compete with the remnants of Xiaomi, I mean, Xiaomi's certainly still selling dozens of millions of phones a year, they want OnePlus to then take up that mantle and compete directly with Xiaomi on the e-commerce side. And that's why, you know, if we see what happened over the last year or so, the team responsible for Hydrogen OS consumed or subsumed the team that did Oxygen OS and brought them into the same fold. Oxygen OS then took on a lot of the aesthetic characteristics of Hydrogen OS, which previously was the China only ROM that the OnePlus devices ran on. So you see a lot of stuff in preparation for the OnePlus 5 being a major force in China. And if there's an 8 gig model, then that's just more fuel on the fire.
And I would say that, I mean, obviously we're very North America focused, but you know, OnePlus, I think, does a pretty good job about understanding where its actual growth and footholds are. If you just look at where they're doing their pop-up events on the 21st and the 22nd, there's one in North America. It's in New York because, you know, you're just going to do something in New York. But after that, they're doing like 8 different pop-up events and they're all in Europe. And that just shows that like they have this foothold in Europe and they do these pop-up events and that's what works. And then at the same time, they understand how the Indian market works. And instead of selling directly from their website, they sell on Amazon India because that's just the way that, you know, they've seen the foothold there. And like you said, they can localize for China as well. And, you know, obviously it's an important phone in the US and Canada, but not in the same way that they've, you know, kind of been able to jump further up the ladder elsewhere.
Yeah, not even close.
So, no. And India and China is the future for any of these companies that make phones.
Yeah, we reported on a new Statista report yesterday. Just to wrap this up again, this is like a Lord of the Rings ending where there's like 4 different endings to the same story. Where, you know, by 2019, India and China are going to be the top 2 smartphone markets in the world. Right now, China's first by a mile, and the US is second, but India's growing far quicker than the US. So that's going to be very interesting. And OnePlus is very, very savvy. I mean, this company, we fault them for a lot of stuff, but they have become a very savvy marketing machine with extremely, extremely potent local marketing that works that morphs itself into whatever region is necessary. So, you know, the way that as Andrew said, the way the phones are sold in India are completely different than China and are completely different than the US and Europe. So we'll find out on June 20th exactly what that looks like. But by God, this is going to be OnePlus's most successful phone by a mile.
I'm looking forward to it. You guys got me interested in the 3T after it was out for a while and you kept praising it. I want to see this one. And I've been hard on OnePlus in the past, but to their credit, they did learn from all their mistakes. They've had kerfluffles in India. They've had kerfluffles with being a little bit sexist and doing some dumb stunts. They learned from all of those, and they are now a much more mature and profitable company because of it.
All right, we're running out of time. We wanted to talk a little bit about the Apple announcements, but we're going to skip those. If you haven't been following what's happening at on the Apple side of things, check out iMore. iMore had amazing coverage of what happened at WWDC this week. Basically, we got new iPads, we got new MacBooks, we got new iMacs. I don't know. We got a bunch of i stuff. Nothing groundbreaking. The thing that I would like to talk about next week is iOS 11 and how it compares to O. Because I was looking at the feature list of iOS 11, and there were just like Android, 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 Android. So it's going to be really interesting. There's a lot of things that Apple's basically stealing verbatim from Android and integrating it into iOS. So maybe that's going to be a good thing for iPhone users. Yeah. But also
the way that they're continuing to iterate on the way that they're doing tablet productivity in a way that Android is completely stagnated interesting.
If I'm Samsung, after WWDC, I stop making tablets and just shelve the entire idea and say I'm done. It's that different now.
Yeah, iOS 11 looks to be a very tablet-centric OS. And I mean, there's an argument to be made that we could have an entire discussion on the millions of people in North America and around the world that have Android phones and iPads, because that's just how bad the tablet market is for Android
users. I have to say, I was pricing out a new 10.5-inch iPad Pro and a smart keyboard yesterday.
I have an iPad mini.
So, yeah, let's stick that on the list for next week and come back to it, because I think it's an important discussion to have. You know, it may be uncomfortable for some people, but you know, you got to get over it. This is a cross-platform world, and Google lives on both of them. So, we'll certainly tackle that in 7 days.
One thing to think about that we can talk about next week is now iOS is fragmented, very much so.
Dun dun dun.
Well, until then, Jerry, where can people find your Android and chill hot takes?
I am on Twitter, at GBHIL. I am on Instagram with the same handle because they were gracious enough to let me get back in my account. And that's about it. That's as much social as I can handle. I'm not good at it.
Well, you're doing good. I was impressed to see you step up your Instagram game during I/O. So
I tried.
Andrew, oh my God, I say Android too many times. Andrew, you have every right. Like the next time you see me in person, you have every right just to slap me across the face with an Android figurine or something. I'm sorry.
I hope I forget by the time I see you next.
It's going to be like Slapsgiving, but the Android figurine version. Where can people find you on the internet?
Same thing as Jerry. It's Twitter and Instagram for me, and you just have to spell out my name, Andrew Martinick. But I would say go follow Jerry on Instagram too. I just became his 180th follower. He needs
at least a couple more
zeros on the end of that.
I'm
great.
Much more comfortable when it's like 5.
Okay, just don't look at your profile because your follower account's going through the roof.
I don't look at that stuff. Somebody asked me about Twitter followers. I didn't even know where to look. I don't want to know that kind of stuff. I'm just going to be me. I don't care.
So humble.
So Jerry. Those are the places you can find me, and I would say go read my Xperia XZ Premium review on the site right now.
It is. It's a good review.
I put some time in that.
It's a great review. I really disagree with it.
I disagree with everything because you said disappointment, and it's Sony, so I have to buy one. But it's still a really good review.
And my name is Daniel Bader. You can find me as well on Twitter and Instagram at JourneyDan. It's Journeyman with a D. You can find all of us at androidcentral.com. Hopefully next week we will welcome back Alex, who has been seemingly away in another...
He works for us still?
Across the world for months
now.
Taipei.
But he's actually been in Taiwan for Computex, and then he took a few days off to tour around. Because why not? When in Taiwan, eat some very delicious food.
I thought that incident with the karaoke bar, I thought he was still in jail.
Hey, we don't talk about that.
Okay.
that's for another time. And Flo, who unfortunately could not be here, but we will hopefully see them again next week. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll talk to you soon.
So long.
Adios.